In these next few days, you will undergo a series of tests.
In 1975...
They will tell us everything we have to know about your bodies.
Don Edmonds directed an exploitation film called Ilsa, She-Wolf of the SS.
Before you embark upon the research program...
The film became quite infamous and widely reviled upon its release.
I advise you to cooperate fully.
Today, nearly four decades later, we're still deeply uncomfortable about the idea.
Any failure to do so will be dealt with very severely.
That women under the Nazi regime could commit such barbaric crimes.
You are here to serve the Third Reich.
But Holocaust scholar Wendy Lauer has challenged this idea with her new book, Hitler's Furies. Were the women who were socialized under Nazi policies to blame for their barbaric acts? Why did the post-war courts allow these women, some of whom massacred children, to return to society without any consequence?
That is your only function.
My name is Edward Champion, and this is The Bat Segundo Show. Lauer's book is difficult to read, and it's very painful to think about the cruelties that are included within its pages. But I think it's an important book to talk about. This program is very much committed to staring hard human realities in the face. So I set up an early morning interview with Miss Lauer during a recent trip she made to New York. Okay, so I am here with Wendy Lauer, who was most recently the author of Hitler's Furies. Wendy, how are you doing?
I'm doing great this morning. How are you?
Pretty well. It's an early morning conversation about the Holocaust. I think you do this quite a lot.
Yes. That's how we're going to start our day.
So let's discuss the idea of genocide as men's work under the Nazi regime. There was this duty to serve the Reich. And anyone who was considered work shy was sent to a concentration camp, of course, to get re-educated. Men were expected to go out and perform an action, which meant, of course, massacring Jews. You have this idea of marriage, where a woman had to be fulfilled with domestic work while she was simultaneously subordinate to her husband. But then you have people like Liesel Wilhaus. She would often shoot at Jewish slaves working on her villa from her second-story balcony for the sport of it. So I'm wondering, to what degree were figures like Wilhaus responding to Nazi societal cues, and to what degree were they reacting to these gender roles that were associated with work?
You know, in a speech that Hitler gave in 1934 at one of the rallies, he was very explicit. He said that women are supposed to serve the Reich to propagate the race, you know, to kind of as baby machines, as it were. He didn't use that term, but that's kind of how we've come to understand it. But he also used the term fellow combatants, which I refer to in my book. And I do that deliberately to show that there were two strands of thinking in Nazi ideology vis-a-vis women and gender roles. One, obviously, predominantly racial, and that the drive to expand the German race. But that drive to expand the German race was about survival. And survival was about militarized operations, you know, expansion of the living space, building of the empire. So you have both women in the role of, you know, expansion of German population to fulfill these megalomaniac global ambitions of Hitler's, and also serving as kind of militarized as fellow combatants. So in there, you see this paradox, right? You see the kind of femininity of the Hausfrau, of the mother, of the wife, but they also are mobilized in these campaigns. And, you know, the uniform culture, for instance, that is very clear theme in my book, when these young women like Liesel Wilhaus, they aspire to, you know, seek careers through the party and better themselves. They're swept up in this fervor and they're mobilized to go to the Eastern Territory. She was sent to Ukraine in this case. So there's social mobility that is possible in the Volksgemeinschaft, but it has both this kind of traditional feminine role as well as this very militaristic, you know, revolutionary experiment.
I guess what I'm trying to unravel here, I mean, I looked also to, like, Erna Petri. Mm-hmm. She comes to the East in June 1942, observing her husband, Horst, beating sexually assaulting servants shortly after arriving in Thuringia. By the summer of 1943, she's already not only an accomplished Hausfrau hostess, but she is also, you know, she invites six starving Jewish children in, and she shoots them in the back of the head. She had heard other Nazis saying that this was the best way to dispose of them. And the thing that fascinates me, and I'm hoping to unravel, I'm hoping to hear you unravel, is how this kind of societal cue of, like, this is the best way to shoot a child, how is that tied into what it was to be a Hausfrau hostess or just be this kind of woman who, as you put it earlier, Hitler called a baby machine?
Yeah, the Nazi experiment tested all kinds of boundaries of matrimony, femininity, child rearing. These are all kind of coming out, I think, in these individual cases that I delve into in a way I obviously put the faces on this lost generation of women and string out these different examples of those who went east. And you've focused on the worst cases of the killers. Erna Petrie is probably the most extreme case in the book that really is the most shocking. But we see even in her case that she starts out as a kind of, ordinary farm girl, farmer's daughter from a town near Erfurt, near Weimar, and attaches herself to a rising star in the SS movement, is then sent east with him to one of these plantations. And they are kind of lording over this estate. So they have a lot of, unsupervised kind of power over the laborers on the estate. And you mentioned that Jewish boys who fled the boxcar that was headed to Sobibor in 43. And she slipped in and out of multiple roles at a given moment. I mean, that kind of, both she was both self-aware of being part of this revolution and wanting to assert herself, to prove herself, but then she had been socialized, in traditional ways of how one should behave as a Hausfrau, as a mother. And these are kind of coming together there's a perversion that takes place here of these gender roles that are instrumentalized, in the genocide. So you have a lot of tension in this history between kind of racial ideals, gendered stereotypes, and this extreme violence that come together in the Eastern territories in particular.
But would you say that a particular gender role encouraged, since this is the best way to dispose of a Jewish child, I will quite naturally fall into this because of just the state? I mean, I'll get into later the fascinating post-war trials in which a lot of these women got away, but I am curious, first and foremost, how many of these roles amalgamated into something. I mean, is it even possible to unravel them? Is it even possible to isolate what could cause someone in one year to go from, to go to this state of being a Hausfrau hostess who thinks nothing of just shooting a child in the back of the head?
I think that these transformations it's a very fluid situation. There's a fluctuation there. It's not, they're kind of moving back and forth. And this is after some intense socialization in the 30s. So yeah. Erna Petrie was born in 1920 and kind of experienced both, in the 1920s, she was very young, but this was kind of the heyday of explosion of women's activity in politics with the, they gained the vote. So you have the politicization of women and that excitement. And then, boom, she's coming of age, in the 30s with that in that kind of atmosphere. But it's being, shaped by this genocide, this Nazi regime, which is highly ideological. And she said even in her testimony that the indoctrination in the 30s was really it was really key to her, was her motive, that she had been taught to hate Jews. And so she's learning things along the way as well. And there's a lot of leeway. There's a lot of room for maneuvering too that we see in her behavior. Many women like her, which was exciting actually for them and empowering. And they were acting out that they didn't assume that this regime was going to come to a screeching halt and be defeated. They just saw a really career tracks opening up and bright futures in front of them. And especially someone like Petrie and some of the wives of these SS men, they had entered into this new nobility under Himmler, and that was even more, another level of kind of being part of a community. And their actions, of course, because of the emphasis on this racial kind of community, Volksgemeinschaft is the German term, people's community, one could act out kind of individually, but also understand one's actions within this society. So later on, for instance, not to jump too far ahead, someone like Erna Petrie and many male perpetrators, you find in their testimony these kinds of defense rationales in the courtroom. I don't know how deep they went in terms of their own psychology, in which they literally state, I feel myself. They use the reflexive case in German. I don't feel myself to be guilty. They don't appreciate the individual responsibility and culpability because of the pervasiveness of this kind of social experiment, being part of a national revolution, and how unity and duty were so heavily stressed, more than, say, morality.
Yeah. Well, I mean, Hitler, as you say, this whole baby machine, I want to go with this further. Basically, he said that a mother of multiple children was more beneficial to the Nazi regime than a woman lawyer. There were quotas in place preventing women from obtaining these degrees in high education and political office. You point to upward mobility in this book as one of the big reasons why these women left villages and they sought jobs. Vera Vuloff, she advanced the social ladder through this office encounter and by marrying this wealthy merchant. So, you know, you didn't have a lot of choices, but there were ways around this. How much of these ambitions emerged from, say, the League of German Girls, which was the girl answer to the Hitler Youth? And how did disregarding and humiliating Jews in the pre-Kristallnacht period lead to this kind of alternative empowerment for women? It's extraordinarily strange, and I'm just trying to isolate certain aspects of this.
Yeah, when I talk about kind of the socialization during the Nazi regime, we break that down. So, for instance, the League of German Girls was compulsory after the mid-30s, so anyone, and for the boys as well, obviously, after the age of 10, they had to be part of these youth movements. And they, you know, predominated and kind of swallowed up all the other activities. And, I mean, the Nazi Party was really clever, insidiously so, in mobilizing the youth. And, you know, for instance, they didn't need to kind of shut down the churches as such. They would just hold a lot of party meetings and these youth programs on Sunday mornings. So people, like, they couldn't go to church. Or they, of course, infiltrated the entire education system. And the textbooks were completely rewritten. So each of these professional groups then were somehow kind of restructured along party lines, this one-party system. Now, in the beginning, thousands of German women, ordinary German women, Jewish women among them, who had been very active politically in the 1920s in the Communist movement, in the Social Democratic Party, the Catholic Center Party, other parties that, you know, the Nazis were destroying basically in 1933 as they consolidated the dictatorship. These women, especially the communists, were sought out, arrested, and many were killed. And German women are also victims of sterilization policies, yeah. About 200,000. So there's a kind of, within the German female population, already in the early part of the 30s, you know, those who might be resistant to these policies are being kind of weeded out, you know, terrorized, incarcerated, and so forth. And so someone like, you know, the individuals in my book, Erna Petrie, Vera, they're kind of, you know, they're not part of that. They've survived that and they've triumphed, and now they've got this bright future ahead of them, and they, you know, can get out of their, you know, Liesel Vilhaus, you know, was the daughter of a foreman in the Tsarland. Worked on a chicken farm, and those who were not the killers in my book, the witnesses and bystanders, similar demographics. You know, they didn't have educations beyond grammar school. They had secretarial training or nursing. You know, obviously nursing training that was essential for the war effort. That particular career path was opened up. So, you know, these are how the socialization happens, and also what it means in terms of how women's lives, you know, their futures kind of shift into these different directions under the regime.
I guess my question is, undoubtedly, they flourished in the power. They flourished in the ability to, you know, shoot down Jews from a second-story balcony or, you know, any kind of attempt at power that they had not had before. And my question is, how much of this desire for upward mobility was there in the pre-League days? You know what I mean?
Yeah, I mean, it's a mass movement. I mean, so much has been written about the Nazi movement as a mass movement. And, you know, beginning with studies of fascism and more recently studies, many of them completed in Germany itself by people like Michael Wild and Götz Ali, about, you know, bringing this whole history down to a kind of social level, you know, the mundane kind of everyday activities. And that's why the women in my book are these kind of very ordinary people we could kind of relate to. And this is significant because you cannot talk about the scale of violence, the power of this regime. You know, on the one hand, you look at something like the footage of the Nazi Party rally that Leni Riefenstahl filmed, right? And you think, wow. And as people did at the time when that was released, it was intimidating. Those are organized marches and you know, rituals and so forth. But now we need to kind of, and what we're doing in my work, and what's really, I think, one of the trends today is to go behind that kind of screen of all those demonstrations and look down, you know, who are the people marching? You know, where are they coming from? Why are they participating in this? You know, why are they falling into line, as it were? And what specifically do they end up doing vis-a-vis the crimes of the regime that have, you know, which are in fact the Holocaust, and these massive crimes are the legacy of the Third Reich. So where do all these kind of ordinary people fit into that? Exactly. And my book, you know, takes them to the Eastern Territories where those crimes occurred. And this is really something I found so astonishing in my work, that there had been quite a bit of research on women in Nazi Germany, and really just so little about those who were sent east. And to just put them on the map of the East, you know, as many as 500,000 women is something new. And now we're, I think my work, although I focus on these 13 women, my hope is that more people will do research on this phenomenon of these kind of communities of violence, and of these, of this, you know, population of young single women who were in the worst settings of the Holocaust.
Well, let's talk about the nurses. Aside from the red swastika sister, you have these women who are serving as nurses who are caring for the stormtroopers. Women such as Annette Schuking, mm-hmm. She's this former law student who's turned nurse. They're thrown into these situations in which they have to listen to all of these German soldiers boasting of massacres, and then they have to comfort them. You point out also in the book how Nazis socialize in a way in which gazing down at the inferior affirmed one's own superiority. My question, though, is what did all this care and confession from men to women do to reinforce gender roles and to sustain this kind of genocidal impulse?
Yeah, and you brought this up in your earlier question, yeah. about the shooting from the balcony.
Yes.
And so what I'm starting to look at and uncover here is the relationships between men and women. Now, Claudia Kunz's earlier work, Mothers in the Fatherland, really powerfully and convincingly established that women were complicit in the crimes of the regime because they kind of created a moral sanctuary at home, and men who had blood on their hands could come home and find that kind of things were normal, and you know, would be even comforted by their wives, or often even incited to do, you know, more violence because of they could depend on their wives who wouldn't judge them. But there's more to the story, because the interaction, if you look at this notion of kind of partners in crime, it operates on different levels. First, you have men who feel the need to talk about what they've done, and they turn to German women whom they feel they can trust. In the case of Annette Schuking-Hohmeyer, I asked her when I interviewed her in March of 2010, why do you think these men were telling you these horror stories? And kind of dumping all this information on your lap and burdening you with that. And, you know, were they boasting or bragging? And she said, no, oftentimes conversations, you know, on these issues, they occurred very quickly, and they felt this need, these soldiers and SS men, to, you know, divulge what they had done. And there weren't a lot of women, German women around whom they felt they could, you know, talk to, because they were out coming back from military service, kind of moving from the front back and forth. She was operating this kind of soldier's home where thousands of soldiers were passing through to get something to drink, and she was kind of a host there. And so they wanted to unburden themselves. And there's several cases in my book of German soldiers who, you know, are sick in the hospital and tell these horror stories to the nurses about mass shooting actions that they participated in. So there's a kind of, you know, sharing of information and unburdening. Then you get the pairing, you know, male-female pairing that occurs in the official office environment. So secretaries and bosses. And it moves up to the next level of complicity, organizing the massacres together in routine kind of organizational, you know, administrative ways that are typical in the modern workplace. And there is shared participation and complicity. And then the last scenario is this situation of men and women in relationships, either husbands and wives or lovers, in domestic settings. Jews are working in their garden. Jews are laborers in their villas, and they are abusing them. And even, you know, in the case of Liesl Wilhaus, Gertrude Siegel, this bizarre pattern of shooting off of these of these balconies, or a combination of kind of sitting around, recreating, coffee and cake, and then they suddenly, you know, things turn horribly, horribly violent.
Yeah. I wanted to bring up Vera Vilhoff again. You point out that various historians have differing ideas about her. She was this woman who brandished a whip and jumped into a truck wearing a military coat and humiliated numerous Jews while pregnant. You observe that Christopher Browning has claimed that men felt uncomfortable by her presence because it made them feel shameful of their acts. Goldhagen says that the men were proud of their acts, but that Vilhoff's presence reminded them that genocide was man's work. Why do you think these historians proved incapable, or if you'll pardon my joke, unwilling to consider Vilhoff's agency?
Well, the focus there was on Order Police Battalion 101. And, you know, let's not forget that the primary perpetrators of the Holocaust were men.
Yeah.
I mean, the estimate now, and these are rough figures, something like 200,000 German and Austrian men were direct kind of perpetrators. This has been the focus of the research, you know, and of the post-war trials and investigations and so forth. So those two studies of Police Battalion 101 were really focused on another question. They were focused on to what extent, in the case of Browning's work, that the battalion, the crimes that Julius Vilhoff, you know, committed in Mazowieckie Poland in this case, you know, was it because of peer pressure? Like, what were the driving forces that you know, what were the motivations that led to these men, you know, participating in these mass shootings when they could have declined, they could have stepped out without punishment. Goldhagen then, you know, examines the same unit and comes to the conclusion that anti-Semitism, eliminationist anti-Semitism, was really at the heart of this. Wasn't peer pressure, but this deadly ideology. And I mean, I don't want to get into that. There's a huge debate about that. And
yeah.
Browning's book has really endured Ordinary Man as a classic, and it's really an important book. And he's been very helpful, by the way, and very with my book and influenced my writing and my research to a large degree. But so they were not looking at the spouse, Vera, you know, in her... on her own terms, you know, like this question of agency. And they had, I know that Browning had looked at her testimony when she was brought in to speak about her husband in the 1960s in Hamburg, and, you know, told me, you know, this was mendacious. She was really lying in this testimony, and,
yeah.
and be careful when you're using it and so forth. But I thought, you know, I wanted to analyze her testimony on those grounds of, well, what were the tricks that she was using to lie, and how did she explain herself as a witness? And did she actually establish, put aside the fact that the debate over pregnancy, which a lot of these women, you know, tried to use their pregnant condition to present to the court that they couldn't be so violent and they couldn't be culpable. And they were really, you know, kind of clever about that. And the courts and prosecutors responded to that. So they manipulated that whole their maternity and their gender to try to get out of being investigated. So I looked and I said, well, you know, she did lie, but she ultimately admitted certain very key things, that she was at the ghetto liquidation. Parading around amongst these victims who had been gathered. And something like 11,000 Jews were deported that day. It was one of the biggest deportation actions. It was horrific. And close to 1,000 died on that hot summer day. Right then and there were shot and were in the heat and brutalized. And she was there. Is she an accomplice because she's there and kind of circulating around? And it seems by some accounts that she was, you know, she clearly was kind of lording over them. She's a German, right? Regardless, male or female. And just by being there and kind of in the way she was circulating, the way the testimony describes it, is a kind of form of, you know, terrorizing these victims. She certainly didn't help them. So I don't, you know, consider her a kind of perpetrator, but she's more, you know, she's certainly an active bystander. And I really wanted to show in her case that, you know, she was at the scene, she did play some part, and then also analyze her post-war testimony and the tricks that some of the German women used when they gave testimony.
That much I get, but I'm wondering why Browning and Goldhagen and company are continuing to argue over Vera while simultaneously using the role of men. I mean, if it's so clear-cut and objective, narrative that she was a perpetrator, why then are all these historians essentially saying, well, it's always in relation to the men? And, mm-hmm. and that, I mean, why isn't there even an ability for scholars to actually imbue Vera with some sort of guilt for her crimes, or to you know, it seems to me that they're kind of softening some of their takeaways, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, I mean, I guess the point you're making, and again, I think she's an accomplice, not a kind of first class, you know, a clear cut case of a perpetrator. But I guess the point is that there's not enough emphasis placed on the interaction of men and women as the source of motivation and the source of the violence. I mean, we can't talk about genocide, you know, as this phenomenon of basically, you know, majority population, socio-political phenomenon, you know, wiping out a minority population, vulnerable minority population, and leave out half of that majority population, in this case, the women. And so, yes, these men went in and carried out, you know, the killing by and large in these militarized killing units, and they were mostly the commandants of the camps and so forth. But what is it about what you know, in these systems in which men and women and youth are participating in, and what is the interaction among the men, women, and their children, you know, who get kind of pulled into this that radicalizes or exacerbates this violence? So I did have an interesting opportunity to share my work, as I mentioned, with Browning, and he made some really good points about how, the men in, you know, Julius and the men in general who participated in this violence and this killing with the women, with their spouses or their would-be mates, their lovers by their side. I mean, they're clearly also trying to prove that they're not cowards. They're showing off their manliness by participating in this. This comes out very clearly in the case of Gertrude Siegel and Felix Landau in the book. So there is this important dynamic, and I think more work should be done on that. I'm trying to establish the importance of it in my book and also to encourage people to do more work on it.
But I guess this goes back to my underlying question. What's the difficulty with separating out this dynamic? I mean, why has it taken us so long mm-hmm. for us to understand that women were part of this too?
Well, I just think because so many things have come together now at this point in the research. First of all, we are looking at German women, as I mentioned before, outside the geographic boundaries of Nazi Germany. Post-Soviet, collapse of Soviet Union has kind of opened up research on the bloodlands, as Tim Snyder calls them. And so now just being able to go to these places and see from the ground up how this violence occurred and that women were indeed there, German women. This is, you know, opening up all kinds of new questions, including the one that you just raised about their kind of co-participation. The killing fields, the notion of killing fields as open settings of violence is also, you know, opening up new questions, because prior kind of general histories of the Holocaust and even general perceptions really focused on the killing centers. You know, I mean, Hitler didn't invent genocide, but he invented Treblinka and Sobibor and these gassing centers, and that, you know, that's understandable that we focus on that part of the research. But what it does when you focus on these killing centers is it kind of puts the violence behind closed doors and behind barbed wire, and it doesn't implicate or doesn't, you know, move us in the direction of asking questions about the general population, German and non-German for that matter, in these sites. So this is also, you know, these developments and then the research are kind of move into these questions now that that we're talking about today.
The German and the Austrian courts, which I had mentioned earlier, after the war, are utterly fascinating. I mean, not only was witness testimony not considered strong enough, especially if it was Jewish, but many of these barbaric women are allowed to actually go back into civilian life. Annette Schuking told you in an interview, it was impossible to talk openly in the court system with any colleagues who had been in the East. Former Nazis were everywhere. Why do you think it took so long for Germany to reconcile with these truths? Why were they so determined to believe that women were just incapable of this savage cruelty?
Well, once the kind of cruelty of women was compartmentalized, was kind of focused on those camp guards. So the early trials were the defendants, mostly female defendants, were these guards like Irma Graiza and Ilse Koch. And in some cases, that kind of the cruelty of women, the evil of women, was depicted in kind of pornographic, you know, located in these kind of eroticized forms. And so these were women who kind of just, they came across as freaks of nature. Although many of the trials, when you start to dig deeper in that immediate post-war period, were actually carried out when there were female defendants against those in the medical profession, because the nurses were very complicit in the euthanasia program. And these cases, you know, again, focused on within West Germany and Austria and East Germany on crimes that had been committed within the Reich. I mean, they were extraditing defendants, mostly male defendants, like Hus, the head of Auschwitz, was sent back to Poland and tried and hanged. So they started off going after the male perpetrators. They were the most numerous, obviously. Those female defendants that were brought, hauled into the courtroom, were mostly, you know, in the nursing profession, in the camp guard profession. But cases against women who participated outside the terror kind of apparatus of the camps were very rare. I mean, outside of Germany, you know, who had committed crimes outside of Germany. About 500 women stood trial in East Germany, West Germany, and Austria. And by contrast, 20,000 German men stood trial after the war. And the conviction rates were low. You can see in the case of Liesel Wilhaus in my book, she was let go. She was indicted in one of the biggest cases in West Germany, the Lemberg trial in the 60s. And let go, and the
with protest as well.
Yeah, well, that was another case actually in Bielefeld. That's Johanna Altfeller. But the Liesel Wilhaus, the woman on the cover of the book who was shooting the Jews from a balcony with a Flaubert pistol, the prosecutor rose. I was very curious. I still don't really know why she was let go. There's a kind of vague note for health reasons. It's kind of a mystery to me. Suddenly, she's no longer, you know, in the dock. And there's a notation in the file that that the prosecutor wrote that her behavior is so contrary to to the female character. I mean, that was explicitly stated in his analysis. And this comes up again and again, not only from the standpoint of the prosecutors and the judges, but also the witnesses, the Jewish witnesses who saw this. They're dumbfounded by the cruelty, the sense of kind of this world turned upside down. Much more desirable to push that kind of world turned upside down into the past. That's the pressure to just put that away, restore civilization, restore kind of normality in some way. And these women, you know, were contrary to that. So there was really kind of even a general will not to deal with this kind of violence in this perverted, paradoxical way.
They were looking to find a blinkered path into the future.
Yes, this Cold War setting is really key here.
Exactly. I mean, while we're on the subject of how women were perceived, I do have to bring up appearance stereotypes, which are fascinating. Johanna Altvater-Zell, also known as Fräulein Hanna, she was an especially evil and sadistic woman who liked to lure children with candy before shooting them in the mouth. She, in one really terrible thing, she picks up this toddler and then, you know, smashes the toddler's head into the wall and drops the lifeless body in front of the father. But because she looked masculine, her behavior was kind of explained this way. There was also this physical ideal you point out before World War II, where women were natural without cosmetics. This was the Germanic ideal. You point to imperial fantasies and hedonism. We've talked about a lot of this in this conversation, but I'm wondering how much this aesthetic ideal encouraged the woman to not only commit more monstrous crimes, but to also allow many of these male magistrates to essentially say, well, you know, this just doesn't fit into, this does not compute.
Yeah, no, it is, again, testing these boundaries of femininity and these roles people are kind of testing out and slipping in and out of, the missus on the plantation, the cowgirl, you know, the pioneer. Yeah. These all come out both in the wartime documentation as well as post-war depictions. And Johanna Altvater is that bizarre hybrid kind of combination of the secretary, the female secretary. Then she gets out to the Wild East, and she's described, you know, she puts the breeches on, gets on the horseback, and this was something that a lot of men were doing. So there's both her kind of asserting herself, there's some mimicry there in terms of, you know, these Westerns. We even could, you know, it's possible that her, very possible that her perceptions were also shaped by kind of fascination in German culture at this time with Karl May and the Wild West. And, you know, this was going to be their frontier, or their manifest destiny. Even the Nazi leaders use these terms. I mean, Himmler talked about the Lebensraum as the Germany's manifest destiny. So some of these kind of images, cultural stereotypes are already, you know, floating around and even being... you know, the leadership is even drawing from that, and that becomes part of the discourse. And she's kind of, you know, moving into that. And then she's, you know, kind of criticized for it too, because, and then her femininity is under the microscope. So some of the nurses who were also stationed in Volodymyr-Volensk, where she was, where 20,000 Jews were killed, you know, her office was basically responsible for the destruction of about 20,000 Jews. She was indicted for, I think, she and her boss for murder, aiding and abetting murder of 7,000 Jews who were mostly killed in September or fall of 42. Anyway, those who observed her actions, you know, they were dumbfounded by her sadism, and they were also puzzled by the way, like the role playing, the self fashioning that she was engaged in, and they started to then refer to her as a she man, and you know, then there were rumors. Well, is she the lover of her boss or not? Yeah. And they weren't quite sure, you know, about her sexuality too. And this was also part of the local discourse at the time and after the war, which is interesting.
One of the constant problems you observe throughout the book is this tendency of women to basically tell scholars, historians, officials, journalists exactly what they wanted to hear. And in looking at this many decades later, how do you as a historian, how does any scholar, how are they able to sort out the genuine truth from the hyperbole?
It isn't easy. I mean, there has been obviously a lot of research done on the Holocaust, but there is this perception, which I find very troubling today, especially as witnesses are passing, survivors are passing, that we know all there is to know. Well, what do we know? And there have been incredible achievements in terms of empirical research, going back to some of the survivors who were scholars, Philip Friedman and Raul Hilberg, going back to the 60s and all the way, you know, to the present day. But we have this explosion of the topic, especially after in the 80s and 90s in the mass media that presented all these stereotypes. And so we're constantly as scholars trying to navigate the situation where, you know, students walk into our classroom and think that, you know, for instance, in my case, all female, when you talk about women and Holocaust German women, oh, there are these, you know, these camp guards and they're running around like wolves or, you know, like animals, or they kind of attribute all kinds of characteristics to them. And so how do you start to undo that through scholarship and scholarship that's accessible and that will raise these new questions, both based on new research, but also tease out and nuance and bring out the complexities of this very history? Because it's those complexities that really, you know, are at the heart of what we do as researchers, and why we keep going back to the archives, that tell us so much about this chapter in our history, but also about who we are as human beings. I mean, the implications of what these women did can clearly be the understanding of what they did. I didn't write this book to shock people. That wasn't my intent, to just kind of horrify and repulse people. Absolutely, the stories are shocking. And that's what happened. And it is, you know, sometimes just incomprehensible. But I try to move beyond that and show that in this kind of, in this history, we can ask very concrete questions and find very basic, you know, answers of who, what, where, why, when, and start to understand how is it that women become transformed, can be hooked on an idea, engaged in a movement, and be, you know, participating in the Holocaust, not because they're freaks of nature or they're passive, you know, they're apolitical or something along these lines, but because they were ordinary German women with many ideas and aspirations, and you know, prior to their involvement in the regime, that many of us can relate to.
Sure. In the epilogue, you suggest that these women had a choice, that they would have been punished for helping victims, that they could have refused to kill Jews without being punished. But I'm wondering, I had mentioned shirking one's duties at the head of this conversation. Wouldn't that be considered an act of nonconformity? Why do you believe that they could have avoided punishment? Was this because German women were underestimated or undervalued?
I'm not sure if I follow your question. Avoided punishment during the regime or after the regime?
No, but you suggest that these women had a choice, mm-hmm. and that they they would not have been punished if they had said, well, I don't want to do
right,
this.
Right.
But I'm trying to align that with the fact that if you didn't do your duty for the Reich, you would be labeled a nonconformist and be thrown into a concentration camp. I mean, why do you say that? What historical evidence suggests that they did have a choice?
Well, they were not, I mean, in all of these cases, and that's why I deliberately chose cases outside the camp system, they were not trained to be cruel. They were not working in systems in which, you know, that was their day-to-day operations, was to lord over these prisoners. A secretary, a nurse, a family member visiting, a spouse, a lover, what have you. We have this showgirl, you know, who's circulating around. I mean, none of these women were officially ordered. I mean, the nurses in the euthanasia program were, you know, given doctor's orders to do this. But the women in my book, the vast majority of them, they, you know, this was not their official role. And so they do have that choice to you know, participate fully or kind of back down. That's clear. But even those who had that official role, referencing the nurses and even the camp guards, you know, there was always latitude. I mean, there was peer pressure within their professions and in their communities. But people were not punished for backing down or being kind of less cruel. I mean, there was room for maneuver there, that I think is really important. But on the other hand, we have to understand that, put ourselves in the minds, you know, not condone, but actually try to understand where these young men and women were coming from at this time. And their perception was that they had to do their duty. So the duty kind of prevailed over the morality. And so the notion that, you know, if they stepped down, like in Browning's work, we would like to think that they would do that, and some did, but that took a lot of courage. Now, if you violated a rule of a law of the regime, if you were hiding Jews, I mean, if you did something that was considered obstructionist, contrary, subversive, you were severely punished. And you know, women were executed, you know, for hiding Jews in Ukraine, for instance. I have a case in the book. They were killed in the Reich, you know, when there were aerial bombings and they were looting. They really needed things, looting from these bombed out houses, brought before these Nazi special courts and executed. The nurse at the end of my book, who's hanged in Danzig, is hanging in the streets of Danzig for making allegedly, you know, anti-war statements, defeatist statements. So violence could be meted out against ordinary German men and women, especially towards the end of the regime in the end phase, in horrific ways if they were considered somehow resisting the regime.
One of your previous books, Nazi Empire Building and the Holocaust in Ukraine, points to this case of Maria Kondratenko, who took advantage of the Nazi idea that women were intellectually limited, emotional, submissive, by leading a resistance movement. You also point out that she was exceedingly rare, and I'm wondering, given how the majority of Germans were forced to either ignore or perpetrate these terrible acts, why do we need to break this down by gender? I get that many of these women were underestimated and that many were not tried. I get that that there was all sorts of pressures that caused them to conform, but I'm wondering, is the ratio of women who tried to fight against the Nazis altogether different from the ratio of men?
You know, these gender image of in this case, the Maria Kondratenko case. It's so great you pulled that out of my earlier work. It's all started, all my research started in Ukraine, in Zhytomyr, Ukraine, and that's what came of it was that first book. And I was so astonished when I came across that case, and I just followed it. I really wanted to see it to the end. And those were SD's, Sicherheitsdienst files, kind of Gestapo files, local Gestapo files, where they were pursuing with great intensity this woman, Maria, who was actually Ukrainian and part of the partisan movement, resistance movement. And they just couldn't believe they were going to these villages and trying to find photos of her. And they couldn't believe that she was part of this resistance ring, you know, was such a ringleader and was so instrumental. And they didn't find her in the end. I mean, they raided a camp and many people were killed brutally. But they didn't identify her among those who were killed. And by the way, when they raided that camp, they did. I remember that report now. It's all came back to me. She was part of a resistance movement with a guy who was given the name Black Misha,
yeah.
Who was a Jewish. Yeah, who was
I can't forget that
a
name.
Jewish person who had fled and joined. So the combination of this Ukrainian woman and this Jewish man who had escaped the mass shootings, it was just driving these local Gestapo officials. You know, they were nuts. They were determined. And so these kinds of, you know, you can see the ideology there, both the anti-Semitism and then this, you know, misogyny, too, in the sense that this woman, how can she be so resilient? How can she have the ability and the power to resist our rule and so effectively? It drove their investigations, even, you know, the intensity of the investigation was that much greater. More people were terrorized. More people were brought in and questioned. And so that's, you know, that's a different history. And it impacted more people because of those perceptions, both gendered as well as anti-Semitic.
But this goes back to my question, why do we need to break this down by gender? It seems to me, I mean, Kondratenko, extraordinary woman, a rare person who actually did try to resist, as are the nurse you had just mentioned. I mean, if there really weren't, as a whole, a lot of Germans willing to resist the Nazis, why should the gender question matter? I that was sort of the question I was hoping to get you to answer.
Yeah. Well, first of all, we don't know. I mean, there's still a lot of research that needs to be done, which I make that point in my book. These are difficult stories to uncover, both on the side of German women who killed as well as on the side of German women who resisted. So there are still a lot of pieces that don't quite, you know, haven't been uncovered. And when we uncover them, they don't quite fit into the nice kind of puzzle that we want to construct. There are a lot of anomalies here. But I think the point is that these perceptions of what would constitute, you know, proper female behavior in these different settings, or, you know, perceptions of what was Jewish. I mean, these biases and prejudices were shaping people's behavior and in the most violent ways. So yes, we have to, when we look at this history, and even class is part of this too. I mean, when I look at the cases of Germans who were arrested and tortured and imprisoned for being quote unquote asocial. We're talking about lower class kind of, you know, prostitutes, people who have, you know, alcoholism, you know, people who have all kinds of, they're on the streets, they're beggars, they're indigent, they've been pushed out of the workforce. So we have a form of terror that is directed towards the kind of, you know, quote unquote underclass in Germany as well. And these are really key to understanding, you know, how policy, violent, even genocidal policies are developed and how they're implemented. Are these very prejudices and stereotypes?
So it is impossible to look and understand genocidal policy without considering what, women's involvement, or the way that Nazis looked down at women and limited them and caused them to act, or the way that a lot of these crimes were swept under the dustbin, so to speak.
I think in order to understand genocide, we have to look at this question of male and female participation, of perceptions of that and expectations, and how they're part of this dynamic. That gender really matters in this discussion. genocide is not confined, it's not warfare to the extent that it's on the battlefield, men fighting men, women in support positions. Genocide is very much this socio kind of economic phenomenon of full societies engaged in all kinds of activities, you know, segregation, pauperization, the terror against population, ultimately leading to their death. There are many facets to the history of genocide as kind of a process of elimination and ultimately the committing of mass murder. And it involves women as much as it does men in all these different capacities, all these different roles.
Well, there's no question of that, but I'm wondering is how, I mean, the gender roles, mm-hmm. how do they encourage a genocidal policy? I mean, because I've been asking a number of questions attempting to isolate things. Yeah. I also realize that a lot of work needs to be done. But, I mean, if you had to tell just some person off the street, look, is it just women did these too, which I totally, I'm glad you pointed all these examples out.
Uh-huh.
But I am curious about how this fits into the great whole of genocidal policy as you know, I mean, what by viewing women and enabling them in these positions mm-hmm. or what? I'm still a little unclear on this.
Well, in the ways that they're mobilized as women in different positions that are considered typical female activities, clerical, nursing, teaching,
yeah.
that is, you know, the kind of the machinery of the Holocaust has a female component to it. And these women are kind of placed into that machinery and they, in fact, feel comfortable there. There's a tradition. And then is kind of perverted, as I said. So this is really, you know, they're key to this history. And they're, both their self-perceptions in terms of their contribution are governed and shaped by how they see themselves as women. And similarly, the men who are developing these policies and really at the seat of power think of women in terms of what their capacities are, and where they're going to fit into this overall experiment and these overall terror operations. So it's there. I mean, it's not something that's marginal whatsoever. It's absolutely the core and the and story of how something like the Holocaust could come about.
But maybe I'm wondering a way to look at this is if you can unpack, for example. You point to the secretaries in this mm-hmm. book and how these women who were serving these male officials, we know, of course, the standard kind of stereotype of a kind of desk man who signs a piece of paper and leads Jews into their death and all this. We know that. You point to the fact that secretaries were very responsible for the administrative component
yeah.
of that.
Yeah.
But one thing you also point out is that the men and the women, they spent a lot of off hours together.
Right.
I mean, you know, it wasn't just casual Fridays. They spent time picnicking.
Mm-hmm.
They spent time consoling each other. Does that kind of thing lead us into the gender roles? Women as comforters, women as nurturers, or is it really just people are spending a lot of time together, so they're going to be more susceptible to any kind of propaganda or societal folkways that encourage them to, say, shoot a Jewish kid in the back of the head?
It's a combination of these things. I mean, first of all, you have the stereotypes or the development of women, you know, their roles in terms of nurturing, you know, assisting, kind of organizing things in the office, you know, the clerical work, nursing in terms of healing, teaching profession as educators, and working, you know, as subordinates in support positions, you know, supporting operations. And so all of these kind of elements of what's considered, you know, a female role, both professionally and in society, yes, they're all part of this history, and we can see how they contribute to the escalation of the mass violence. And then we see, like, women as consumers is also my book, which I think yeah. is interesting, the rise of consumer culture. We can't talk about the boycotts of Jewish shops and the, you know, transformation of the German economy without looking, going down onto the street level to the marketplace and show how ordinary German women, you know, they're the ones who are going into these shops or not, and making those kinds of day-to-day decisions about where they're going to shop, and or they're working in these department stores, and suddenly, you know, a famous Jewish chain in Munich or in Berlin that was owned by a Jewish family, suddenly the whole structure of their organization changes and they have new bosses. Or when we get out to the Eastern territories, they're often at the center of this kind of culture of consumption. The items that are brought, deportees who are brought to Minsk with their belongings, you know, all that loot is then distributed in the office, and the women are kind of organizing that. They, Sabina Dick, the secretary in Minsk, talks about these items, Judenwurst, like they have different language that they develop about this booty, and in a really kind of, I mean, they make light of it, you know, and then they're indulging in it with great relish, you know, to have get their hands on everything from personal belongings, clothing of Jewish victims, to their actual knapsacks, you know, that had food in them, and women setting up, you know, refreshment tables, because the kind of mass shootings that occur in places like Babi Yar and Minsk, this was considered, you know, these were all day events that were hard labor. I mean, that was how it was understood. And so the men, you know, needed they had to set up, they had to be fed during these actions. And women kind of stepped in and played that role as well.
This is obviously a lot to unpack, and I have one last question for you. You focus a bit on how the Red Army soldiers raped many of the German women, and it was anywhere from 100,000 to 2 million, depending upon who you talk with.
Mm-hmm.
I'm wondering how this contributed to this post-war culture in which women not only could not talk about what they experienced, but also could not be held accountable.
Right. Well, you had this dichotomy or this kind of polarized picture of German, ordinary German women's experiences during the regime. And the more passive version, which could be, you know, first on the home front, not mobilized and actively contributing to the war effort into the Holocaust, an extension of that was this, the victimization narrative of German women at the vis-a-vis the mass rapes, the Red Army reoccupation and of Berlin, for instance. A lot of really good work on that done by Atina Grossman. And yes, indeed, these crimes occurred against German women, and they were horrific and at the end of the war. But it, of course, overshadows what happened before, up until 45, and how German women were complicit in these crimes prior to they themselves being victims of war crimes on the part of the Red Army. So after the war, although rape, of course, is a topic that is also has its taboos, and it was clear that these crimes had been committed, but kind of only recently have more fuller discussions been generated about it. A diary was published at first anonymously on the plight of one woman in Berlin. So it took time also for that discussion to come into kind of full view, and it's still occurring. But this perception of the German woman as a victim of these crimes, and often by extension a kind of victim of the Nazi regime, that they were the martyrs of, you know, it was a disaster, the Nazi experiment, and somehow they could kind of stand apart from that and be innocent of that. And by being innocent of that, we ultimately kind of remove them from the history, from modern history. And so now we have to question that narrative of innocence and victimization, and evil, you know, that they were the rebel women cleaning up the mess after the regime was defeated and so forth. And this is what my book is trying to do, is to go back and kind of unpack, you know, to what extent were women kind of victimized, and in the other extreme, to what extent did they actually participate in the crimes?
Well, it's a good first step in discussing this issue. Wendy, thanks very much. It was a pleasure to chat with you.
Thank you.